because of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we are, in fact, your dear children. That you not only are the author and protector of our faith, you're also the protector of all that we do. In your eyes, our efforts are indeed perfect. That gives us the gospel motivation and strength to undertake this arduous task of being parents. Lord, we ask you to bless this time together, that we may grow in your word and in the understanding of what it means to be part of your family as your dear children. All of this we pray in the name of your Son. Amen.
My name is Joe Barber, in case some of you don't know, and most of you probably don't. But the speaker that we have this morning is Kimberly Kleckner. She comes of her own free will and of her own good graces. It is a blessing that she would be willing to present her expertise without reimbursement, and all of our speakers today are doing that, and we owe her special thanks for that. But Kimberly Kleckner is a 1979 graduate of Concordia College, River Forest, with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Early Childhood Education. From 1979 until 1985, she served as director and teacher of preschool programs in congregations of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. In 1987, she earned a Master of Science degree in Child Development from Iowa State University. Mrs. Kleckner has received leadership training in parent education programs, courses, and workshops. She holds professional memberships in the National Association for the Education of Young Children, the St. Louis Association for the Education of Young Children, and the Lutheran Education Association, Department of Early Childhood Education. Mrs. Kleckner is currently employed as an early childhood specialist with the Child Daycare Association of St. Louis. And we welcome her this morning. And thank you for coming.
What we want to talk about, at least initially, is some of the developmental characteristics of preschool-age children, and we want to especially focus on children who fall between the about 2 to 2.5 age range up to about age 5. So, and the reason we're focusing on that age is some things happen to children between that second and third year that really change their nature, so to speak. And so we want to talk about some of the characteristics, some of what they start to become when they become preschoolers rather than toddlers in your household. The areas that we want to focus on are physical, social, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. And we're going to talk just a little bit about those characteristics, and what I'd like for you to do is to share from your experience what some of those characteristics are in each of the areas. And then later we'll talk about three real crucial, I think, areas there in terms of your role as parents, in terms of nurturing the development of your preschoolers. So let's start with some of the physical characteristics of preschoolers, and what can you tell me about preschoolers in terms of their physical characteristics? Energy, okay, high levels of energy. They're real energetic, they experience things through their bodies, and that's going to be the way they learn the most, is through their bodies. And so you can expect them to be real active and get very frustrated when they're not sometimes. And it's really difficult for them to control those body movements that really tend to push them on and push them on and push them on. It's difficult for them to sit for long periods of time. Sunday mornings are probably going to be very difficult if you've got preschool-age children. That's part of the physical characteristics, however, of the preschool child. They need lots of opportunities for gross motor play as a result of that. Lots of opportunities to get outside and run around and burn off steam and all those kinds of things. Those are going to be given. And so children who spend a lot of indoor time are really going to have a tougher time, probably, with some of the sitting still. At times you want them to sit still because their bodies are saying, I need to move, I need to move. And they really do need to be given those opportunities. What are the other ones? Some of the other physical characteristics of preschoolers? Okay, they're beginning to learn about space and spatial relations and where their body is in connection with other things. But since it's just beginning to learn about those kinds of things, the coordination isn't quite as developed. And so they are going to bump into things and knock over things and think that they maybe have some abilities that they quite don't have yet. Okay, others? Okay, they enjoy touching. They love to be cuddled. They love to be hugged. I think oftentimes we as parents, as soon as children start getting bigger, and maybe it doesn't happen in the preschool years, they're still kind of cuddly and lovable and little. All children need that touch, that sense of physically being reminded that they're loved and cared for. And I think it's something that we tend to back off on, especially as they get more increasingly aware of their bodies, maybe in the adolescent years. And yet, that's a time when they really need to be reassured that their bodies are okay and that they're really accepted and that they're loved by their parents, because when they look in the mirror, they usually don't like what they see. And so they really need that touching and that reminder that who God made them is valuable, not only for them personally, but also valuable to God and to you as a parent. Okay, other physical characteristics. Okay, real good comment. It's something in terms of their need for a concrete experience, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we talk about intellectual abilities too, but they need to experience things by doing. Many of the things that you try to get across just by telling them may not sink in, but if you can give them a picture of it or if you can let them practice it, that's what's going to make it really stick for them. And that's really true of us as adults, too. I don't know how many of you have had the experience of sitting through an object lesson, but it seems to me that adults kind of really key in on those object lesson messages as much as the children do. It really is helpful to see things and to visualize things while you're trying to make these pictures and representations in your mind. So that the concrete experiences for children, the real physical kinds of experiencing of things, are real crucial. Okay, they are getting pretty well developed in terms of their self-help skills, their abilities to do things around the house for you, help you set the table, make their beds, and those kinds of things. They're getting more competent at those kinds of skills. And it's real crucial when we talk a little bit later in terms of social and emotional development, it's real crucial for you to give them lots of opportunities to do those kinds of things, to be a help around the house. What it does is reinforce for them a feeling that I can. Look at how much I can do. This is what my body's able to do, and I'm getting better at all these things all the time. And so it may mean that when you walk past their bedroom door, you have to kind of look the other way when the sheets are hanging down below where the bedspread is and the pillow's still kind of lopsided or whatever. It may not look as nicely made as what you might be able to do, but the child has done it, and that's what makes it a real successful thing for them. So the more you can involve them in that, the better it is. Right, and we're going to talk about that struggle. Very much so, preschoolers are at an internal struggle between feeling independent and wanting to assert that independence, but still knowing that they need people, that they need adults. They're going to really swing back and forth, and sometimes that's the toughest thing as adults to deal with, the fact that children swing from extremes. At times they seem very dependent on you and very much in need of you, and other times they're so stubborn and so assertive, and it's like, I don't need you. They get that kind of an attitude, and they're going through that emotional swing, and that should be expected behavior. You shouldn't look surprised when they give you that kind of an extreme, and it's a real important struggle for them to go through and to resolve successfully. So don't seem surprised when it's happening, nor get too irritated with the fact that it is happening, because it's a normal part of the developmental process for them. Okay, it's also really difficult for them to separate physical activities, thinking activities, and feeling activities. We as adults can kind of compartmentalize those sorts of things. We can think something and not need to go and do it. But for a young child, when they get a thought of something, it immediately makes their body want to react. And so the distractible kind of thing, those of you who work with preschoolers and have had to sit them down and want to get a story across, well, if for some reason something distracts their attention, they're likely to get up and wander away because their mind saw something, so their body follows. And same thing in terms of emotional control. We're able to feel something without having our bodies need to express that feeling. But for young children, when they feel something, their body's going to show it. They're going to throw a tantrum when they're angry. They're going to really sulk and kind of huddle down when they're sad. You're going to be able to tell from body posture with them what their feelings are. They haven't learned to mask that kind of a thing. And I think that's a real crucial thing to remember. They're pretty easy to read from that perspective. The child, in terms of physical nature, too, is very much a here and now kind of a person. He has little foresight, little ability to think of the consequences of what it is his mind engages his body into doing. And so what you want to do is begin to help them realize that there are consequences for the choices that they make. And we'll talk about that when we talk about strategies for guiding behavior. But at this point in their development, they're not able to separate those kinds of things. They're not able to decide ahead of time, well, if I behave this way, this is what's going to happen to me. Or if I pull the tablecloth out from under the table when there's a vase of flowers on it, I can't foresee that that vase of flowers is going to knock over and there's going to be water and flowers spilled everywhere. Those kinds of things they cannot see ahead of time. So a lot of the things that we think of as being, oh, why didn't you just think before you did that, they can't do that yet. They don't have the foresight. And it's going to be a developing process and something that we can really encourage in the ways we handle some of the behavior incidents that we encounter with young children. Okay, let's move beyond the physical nature of children and talk about the social nature of the preschool child. Any input there? You may have heard the word, go ahead. Okay, they're getting to be very much more social creatures, very much more peer-oriented kinds of people. You made a really nice point in terms of the type of play they get involved in. Earlier than the 2.5 to 3-year-old stage, children may play in the same space, in the same room, and whatever, but what they engage in is what's called parallel play. They will be playing next to each other without interacting with each other. And that's where you get into a lot of the fighting over the toys and whatever, because it's not, I don't care what you're doing over there, I want, and what I want is this toy because I'm playing here. It's not we're playing cooperatively, it's I want to play and this is what I'm doing. And before I become socially focused, it's really tough for me to start learning some of the sharing kinds of things that are sometimes expected too soon from real young children. So yeah, they're becoming more social creatures, and that's an important thing. They're beginning to feel some empathy for other people's feelings. They're beginning to get concerned about how other people feel. But it's not highly developed, and so it's something that we can help nurture and help foster and encourage in children, but they're not there yet. So it's not an accomplished thing. It's not when that third birthday hits, they're suddenly social people and they know how to behave in every social situation and they're polite to each other and they share and all of that. It'd be nice if there was just a snap of the finger and they became that way. But I want to emphasize how crucial your role is and also the role of other people in terms of helping them develop appropriate social behavior, appropriate social skills. A lot of things that children learn, they can learn just through concrete experiences, through experiencing the world, through being in a room full of educational materials, and all those kinds of things are things that children can learn that way. They can learn some things from watching the TV and watching movies and all those things. They can pick up information that way. But they will not learn social skills without the guidance of an adult. It's not something that can happen. And a lot of that has to do with the old Adam within. We're going to be selfish and greedy people until somebody else shows us that that's not the way to get along with other people. And so it's really crucial. We play a real crucial role in terms of the social skills that young children develop. Okay, another thing that's important to mention here is how young children identify peers and what they think friends are. Friends don't have the same connotation to a young child as what they have to an adult. You may build friendships as an adult because you share some common concerns, you have a person who you can depend on and trust, You have a person who really understands your feelings and needs, and it's all based on some of those kinds of real deep understandings that are shared between you and another person. For the young child, a friend is someone that they define as somebody who they share time with or they share interests with. And so their friends can change like that. Somebody that they played with one day and had a wonderful time interacting with them with those particular materials, that may be their best friend. But that same best friend certainly isn't anything like the best friends that you and I think of with whom we've established long-term relationships. And I think that's an important thing. I think it helps not to necessarily worry when a child says, well, he's not my friend anymore. What that may mean is nothing more than I didn't play with him today, or I didn't feel like playing with him today, or he was playing with something that I didn't want to play with today. So don't read more into that kind of a phrase than what might necessarily be there. In terms of their social abilities, though, they are still dependent on adults. They depend on adults for love. They may not get that real consistently from peers because peers are still working on that those beginning social skills. That still isn't well developed. So they depend on you for love, for reassurance of love. They need you for guidance, as we had talked about before, in terms of what's acceptable behavior and what's not acceptable behavior. They need you for comfort, and they need you to help them start to develop their own controls. So those areas are really important. They're very eager to please, generally speaking. That doesn't go for every minute of every day. But generally speaking, they really do want to please the adults around them. And they also are going to be quite imitative. Some of you may have some stories about that in terms of things you've seen your children or children you teach do in terms of imitative behavior. I can think of an instance in terms of my preschool teaching where I had said to a child who was in a rather silly mood one day something about cutting out that monkey business, and saw a couple days later that same child in the housekeeping area holding up a doll and saying, "Now you cut out that monkey business." I thought, oh, I wonder where she heard that. Fortunately, that's the worst that I've heard from a child, although I'm sure they could imitate and repeat some things that I would rather they not. But I'm sure you've got some examples of that. Children want to be imitative of adult roles, and it's part of the social learning process. It's real important for them to have opportunities to practice those roles. So when you see them in your closet trying to pull your clothes out to put them on, they're really indicating a need to do some imitative sorts of things. And it's real important to give them lots of opportunities to play out those roles. I will go on and talk and talk and talk, and I want to give you lots of opportunities to ask questions if you've got questions. So don't hesitate just to raise a hand or whatever at any point in time and say, well, what about, or whatever, or if you've got an example of something to share, please do that. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, the one comment that the friend business, okay, and they say, well, she's not my friend anymore. Well, I have a 5-year-old, and her feelings get hurt very easily, and this happens quite a bit. And I can remember the first time it happened, I almost laughed out loud because I, you know, you just, it happens for the first time, you expect this thing to happen, and then, oh, here it is. Okay, but what do you say to them? You know, she's 5. It's a little bit different than a 2-year-old saying that. I mean, you can easily distract a 2-year-old, mm-hmm. but she's just crying her heart out because, you know, her best friend said that she just doesn't want to play with her anymore. Mm-hmm. And 10 minutes later, I know it's going to pass. What would you suggest, or how would you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the most crucial things, I think, is for children to understand when they're upset that you empathize with them, that you know they feel real sad about that. And it is sad when a friend says, I don't want to play with you anymore. And so to acknowledge that to a child, I think, is one of the real important first steps in helping them deal with that. So it's not, oh, don't worry about it, in 10 minutes she'll really be your friend or anything like that, because we have the foresight to be able to know that. We know age characteristically that's what likely will happen. But to that young child, she's got some real hurt feelings, and those feelings need to be addressed. So You know, it's reassuring her, I'm really sorry that happened, I'm really sorry you feel that way. It does make us feel sad when people don't want to play with us. Maybe tomorrow she'll want to play with you. Is there something, you know, is there an activity where you'd want to invite her over so that she could come and spend some time with you? You know, help the child kind of brainstorm about ways to encourage more interaction with that child, even though today it might not work. Any other suggestions from other parents who maybe have encountered a similar thing?
I think that sometimes when that happens, they're just feeling kind of empty and alone, and they tell you about it because they would, if they can't play with this friend, maybe mom can give them some special time, you know, and it might be a good chance to do something that they really like to do, and just a little one-on-one, if it's possible.
Realistically, I would love to.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be at that moment in terms of giving the one-on-one. You know, if it can't be done at that moment, but you sense that she probably would need some encouragement and some feeling that somebody really does want to spend time with her, if you can work it in at some point during that day or say, I'd really like to spend some time with you just alone, and what would you like to do, and let's plan something for Saturday, or let's plan something for whatever, and help, you know, pull out the calendar, and it's this many days till Saturday, and we'll do this together on that day. I think that can help ease some of that, too.
I think there's a little of a split between these friends. Like, I was involved in the Latch Key program for a year over at Captain School. There are these three boys, and every day they took turns. Well, I don't want to play with Leo, or, you know, and so this little boy would go over and just sob, you know, and all he wanted to do was play with them. Do you go to the other two boys and say, get over there and play with Leo and enjoy it, or what, you know?
Yeah. Right. It's one of those things where you really can't force children to play with each other because they're going to say what they're going to say, even if you as an adult are standing over them saying, now you all play together nicely. They're going to, you know, be growling under their breath or making nasty jabs with the elbow or whatever it is they can do to convey the fact that they really don't want to be there doing that. I think it is important to help the children who are saying those things to recognize what effect it's having on another child. You have to remember that those social skills and becoming empathetic toward other people are just a developing kind of a thing. And so they need to hear and they need to see that what they're saying and doing really is hurting someone else. And it may be that you pull all three of them together and, you know, talk about why is it you don't want to play with him? You know, is there some role that he could play? It may be that they're both playing some kind of a game that for some reason there are only two roles in that game. And to bring in a third just seems to the children that it would not work. And then brainstorm with them about ways, well, could there be two of such and such a character in this game? Or, you know, help them try to strategize ways so that all of them can play cooperatively. Sometimes it's important to say to a child who's upset, I'm sorry, that it looks like they really don't want to play with you today. Is there something else you would like to do? On another day, they may be willing to play with you, and I'm sorry that they're feeling that way today. But help that child understand that it's not him so much as the whims of this other group of kids. It's not they're picking on you, but they're special buddies today and they really want to spend some time together. And so let's try to think of something that you could do with another child or with me or whatever to help ease that.
I haven't had an experience with you, but one day it just really got out of hand. Week after week, and we were in the playground, and well, I know I can't spank the kids, but so I made them, I don't know if this is wrong or if I emotionally scarred them, but I made them sit in the middle of the playground, all three of them, and we have what's called timeout, you have to sit there. So I made them have a timeout together in the middle of the playground, and I made them sit there for a half hour together, and a half hour seems like a long time. It really started out just to be a 10-minute timeout. But they just, when I went over there to tell them, you guys can get up now, they said, no, it's okay, we're having a good time. And they stayed there for a half hour.
So they really almost chose that half hour time in terms of...
They They didn't fight for the rest of the day. And on other occasions, I said, the next fight I hear, are you all going to time out for the rest of the day? And I guess I feared, put the fear of them that they had to play together, but these were all the children. They were about 8 or 9, and so I think they understood a bit more than a 5-year-old.
Yeah, it can get real frustrating. What's that?
Preschool, and then my girl from first grade comes home, and then there's the preschooler's friend over there, and then the preschooler's friend wants to play with Anne because she's older, and then there's my preschooler left out.
Threesomes are real difficult. They really are, and you probably as adults aren't real comfortable with threesomes either. I know when my husband and I have people over, and the person that comes over is like another SEM student, and it's the three of us. Usually the guys start talking about classes and profs, and I'm not thinking about the classes and profs. So it ends up, you feel like a third wheel. It's like, well, I could just leave and do something else. And as an adult, you handle that a little bit better, but as a child, it's real frustrating to try to deal with a threesome. Yeah. Okay, let's look at some of the emotional characteristics of preschool children. As I said before, they're going to express their emotions in very physical ways. They're not able to separate feelings and thoughts and actions yet, so you can expect them to express anger and joy and the whole range of emotions that they can experience in very physical ways. They begin to understand what promises are all about, and their feelings can be easily hurt when those promises don't fall through, when those promises fall through. And I think that says something to us about how we say things to children, what kinds of promises we make, even if we don't say, I promise. If we say, this afternoon we're going to the zoo, and for some reason the schedule just doesn't work that you get to the zoo that afternoon, to a child, that's a broken promise. You told them something would happen, and it didn't happen. And so as much as possible and as early as possible, you forewarn a child. Boy, it looks like we're not going to be able to get to the zoo today, and I'm sorry. And I said that that was something we were going to do, but it's just not going to work. We'll have to choose another day to do that, rather than hoping that they won't notice that you didn't go to the zoo and have it be supper time before they even recognize that that's what happened, which likely they encounter is a real emotional outburst at that point in time. But I thought we were going to the zoo today. And possibly some accompanying misbehavior because of that disappointment. So it's real important to anything that you promise to follow through with that for them. They're beginning to establish some behavioral control. We're going to talk for quite a while on guiding children's behavior because that always seems to be an issue that's of most importance to parents and is crucial to teachers as well. The other thing that I want to say, and I'm not sure if emotional development is the place to talk about this, but they have difficulty separating reality and fantasy. And so when they tell you something, and you know what they're telling you is not true, it probably is not an intentional lie, at least from the very young child. They may be telling you something that to them is nothing more than a tall tale. They're using their imagination, they're making this elaborate story, and to some extent, depending on the issue, it's appropriate to play along with that. So if a child tells you, well, when I came home from school, you wouldn't believe what I saw, and tells you this phenomenal story about some huge something that was standing behind a tree and whatever, it's one response of a parent to say, well, you know that there aren't such things in the world and there's no way that that's what you saw, or, oh, really, and how big was it, and what did you do about it, and whatever, and kind of playing along with them, letting their imaginations go for a while. Now, you may not want to do that when it's something that's a little more serious an occasion because they're beginning to learn the distinction between reality and fantasy, and it's important to help them make that connection. But they're not there yet. And that's why things like scary movies on TV or at the movie theater have profound impacts on young children. Nightmares and daydreams and fears and all kinds of things can develop from that. I know a real big thing at a lot of the daycare centers that I visit now is that children are terrified of Freddy Krueger. And I don't know how many of you have even watched, but it's an ongoing series and it's on TV, and I'm not sure who's letting these children watch it, but it's certainly not something that a preschool child can handle. Freddy Krueger is the character in Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's a person who only appears when people are sleeping, and is a person who's only in dreams, but he's a real frightening character who's either got razor blades or hypodermic needles or something on his fingers and comes and grabs people and attacks them and whatever, and it's really a frightening kind of a thing. To allow children to experience that really is asking for building some fears in them that they're unable to distinguish from reality. And so it really is essential and crucial that you as parents are monitoring what kinds of media experiences your child is getting. It's real crucial. The other thing, and this is kind of a personal bugaboo, but I'm going to share it anyway, is that I think you need to be real cautious about how you handle Santa Claus versus Jesus Christ. Because Christmas is a holiday, unlike some of the other holidays, although Easter and the Easter Bunny and the resurrection, I think, are things that also can get kind of messed up in a young child's mind anyway. But the tooth fairy really doesn't have spiritual connotations. It doesn't happen at a time that connects with anything spiritually. But to emphasize Santa Claus and the role that Santa Claus plays and to have children believe in that figure at the same time that you're talking about a Jesus who you can't see but who really is real, who comes at that same time of year and brings us good gifts and all those kinds of things. But then suddenly to have a child a few years later discover that, whoa, Santa Claus isn't real. What does that mean in terms of what they've heard about Jesus and who he is and his reality? Now, it's a personal thing on my part, and so I don't want to say never involve your child in Santa Claus and whatever, but I'm saying be real careful in terms of how you handle that kind of a thing with a very young child, knowing that they're at a point where they're really struggling with what's reality and what's fantasy, and at what point does fantasy stop and reality begin. Any suggestions?
A lot of cartoons and a lot of fictional characters. They know that those are fictional characters, these are cartoons. And if you treat Santa Claus in the same way as a cartoon, as a fictional character, as Big Bird, or whatever fictional characters, they can understand that that's just like Big Bird and all the other fictional characters, and they don't have that problem.
Yeah. It's going to be real difficult to not expose your child to that, because as soon as Thanksgiving rolls around, there are Santa Clauses in every department store, and you know, there's just no way to not give them an exposure in some way, shape, or form to that. But helping them understand that it's a person in a costume and the different stores have different Santas and all that kind of thing, I think, is probably appropriate. You may want to focus on the person that Santa Claus represents, St. Nicholas, as a real person who was a good person and did nice things for people. But that it's not, Santa is not some magical person who suddenly drops presents off at your house unexpectedly and isn't he wonderful and whatever. I think you need to be real careful from that perspective.
I don't know if this is true or not, but my husband and I are struggling with that, because when we were home to my family over Christmas, they're not Christian. I've never in my life experienced anything so empty. And I grew up with this. And I fond memories of Christmas and stuff, but I've been away from it for a couple of years, and when I went back and saw my nieces and nephews involved with this, I've never felt so empty in my whole life. And Tom and I are struggling with it. Our kids could probably go another Christmas or two and not even realize that they were supposed to get presents.
Mm-hmm.
They can't read a calendar. They don't understand it. But if you want to go to the extreme, there is a St. Nicholas Day. Like December 13th or something, I can't remember the exact date. Make that the day that Santa comes, and just keep Christmas. Don't give presents on Christmas Day. Now that's to the extreme, and this isn't what we decided upon. This is just something we're considering, and something we're going to have to take in about a year or two when Joshua realizes that all the kids at Sunday school are getting presents today, and they can't wait to get home to wait till, you know, Tom's done preaching so they can go home and get those presents, you know. So I really struggle with that, too.
I think another possibility is why do the presents that arrive on Christmas have to be presents from Santa Claus? Why can't they be presents from mom and dad and presents from brothers and sisters and presents from aunts and uncles? And why does there have to be some mystery package from some fantasy person? Mark?
Just a general comment, you can throw it in wherever you want to sit. I think a mistake, at least from my perspective, and then we'll find out if you get more directly active in our own parenting role, but listening to friends who have kids, they often make the mistake of assuming that it's too early to start dealing with kids, be it helping around the house, be it doing whatever. Sort of like, well, there's this magical age called very early childhood in which you've got this very innocent little thing who is totally incapable of doing anything and determining reality and whatever. I think a lot of it is you start dealing with the child as a young Christian, regardless which of these categories we're in, from day one. You may occasionally go over the top of their head, but if you don't make this phony distinction, that from day one stress, Jesus is a real person, and Jesus came as a baby just like you were, and do that from day one, that's their understanding, the faith that Spirit puts in our heart, and the form that we help give to that as they're able to develop language skills and things. I think if we start from day one on, we'll have a lot less problems. I know we have friends in Des Moines who this falls more in the emotional discipline range. They would let their kids get away with everything because, they're too young, they won't understand until age 4 or 5, they're having problems. And we told them about friends of ours, an assistant pastor in the Cleveland area, who at 2 and 3 had beautifully behaved children. And our friends didn't ask, well, how is that even possible? Well, it's because you laid out the rules and understandings and whatever from day one. And that's the way the kids develop.
One important thing to mention developmentally is that children understand more up here before they can begin to express it here. And so what you say to them may have meaning that they can't even begin to express to you in terms of how much of it they're understanding. But they're taking it all in. And preschool ends up being kind of a fun age level to deal with because children have growing communication skills. The 2-year-old is still working on getting those phrases out and may not get them out real clearly and is beginning to put sentences together, and words are a wonderful thing for the 2-year-old. But the preschooler then becomes able to use words to really communicate and converse and whatever. And sometimes that can get frustrating because it's always, well, tell me about this, or why did this happen, or whatever, and it's a constant barrage of why, and being real curious about everything. But really, it's a wonderful age, and that's, I think, unfortunately, as Mark was saying, when parents say, well, now they can talk back to me, now I can start to help them understand some of these kinds of things. Well, they're understanding things well before they can express things back to you verbally, and so it's really important to start from the very earliest, giving them some of those.
What about imaginary friends? When is it healthy? When is it not healthy? When do they start to develop those imaginary friends?
That is probably something that's going to develop right during the age range that we're talking about. And this is probably as good a place as any to talk about it in terms of emotional development and social development. Children will develop imaginary friends, and they do so for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's because of their need for some social support. And sometimes it's just a process of the imagination of their mental and intellectual abilities at that point in time. In terms of handling imaginary friends, I think it's fine to play along with it for a child. If they have an imaginary friend who they have at the table with you every night for supper and you need to set a plate out and forks and spoons and pretend that somebody's sitting there, that's perfectly appropriate to do, to play along with it, because it's something that children outgrow when their sense of peers, the real world of peers, becomes increasingly important to them. But it often happens in families where there is not as much social contact or not siblings in the family for whom they can play with and relate to. It becomes an idea, hey, I'd like to have somebody who's with me all the time, sort of a thing. And so they invent this person who's very real to them.
develop. It could be a process of being isolated or maybe not being enough.
You may want to encourage a little more social behavior, but it may just be a stage for that particular child and not something that you have to panic about and think, oh no, they've got an imaginary friend. It means they don't have enough friends outside of the home and I've got to do something about it. It's not that kind of a thing. It's recognizing that this is a stage that they're going through. I'll encourage and foster that imaginary friend relationship, but I'll also provide opportunities for other social relationships. And that often happens once they start school anyway. They're going to be surrounded by other social relationships and almost can't avoid having that step in.
And it did diminish when she started school, but now I'm not seeing that developing in our two younger children, and I was concerned that they're not developing their imagination as much.
It's not something that every child goes through. Certain children, for whatever reason, be it emotional makeup or genetic characteristics or who knows what, some children have that need and develop that kind of a thing, and other children do not. It's definitely not something where every child's going to experience this, and if your child doesn't, there's something wrong. Okay. Go ahead.
About Jesus, I had a lot of preschoolers that for a while Jesus was their imaginary friend. That with us, and it was good in the fact that they were remembering that, you know, and it kind of curbed their behavior to the good because Jesus was there doing it with them. But I didn't know if it okay for them to have Jesus as their imaginary friend.
And I don't know that you necessarily need to say imaginary friend because he's not imaginary. He is a real being. We just can't see him. And I experienced the same thing as I was teaching preschoolers. As a matter of fact, when we would sit down for snack, they would make sure that there was a place at the table for Jesus. And when we would have our story time, they would pull out a carpet, and that was Jesus' carpet square so that Jesus could listen to the story too. And I thought that was really a wonderful and beautiful expression of what is the faith of a young child, to recognize that it was somebody they couldn't see, but his presence was very real, enough so that he needed a place to sit too. And so I would not phrase him as imaginary friend, but invisible friend, yes. Yeah, very much so. Okay. All right. In terms of intellectual development, the preschooler has a growing reasoning ability, which we talked about a little bit. They're going to be asking why a lot, and you will hear a lot of whys in terms of discipline techniques that you use. Well, why can't I do such and such when you say whatever? That's not disrespect. And it's real easy, I think, for parents to think that children are being sassy or children are being disrespectful or children are talking back when all they are doing is expressing to you the fact that their mind and their reasoning powers are getting stronger all the time and they really want to understand. They really have a need to understand things intellectually. They're beginning to master language, so they're very conversational. They enjoy having choices. And we're going to talk a lot about choices when we talk about discipline and guidance techniques with young children because it's real crucial to give them opportunities to practice that and to practice not only making those choices but also following through with whatever the consequences are of the choices that they do decide to make. Here.
Going back to your why, like even in discipline, I did that like with my oldest two. You know, I was explaining to them, well, this is why you're going to sit on a chair and this is why you're going to do this, and this is why this is happening, and whatever. And now that they're getting older, I'm going, I'm tired of telling you why all the time, or even if I told you once, and then they come back at me again with, you know, just trying to get away from it. How long do you keep I'm going, you get this. Christy, to me, is like an older five-year-old. She's preschool, but she's five and a half, not just turning five. You know, and Anne's already in first grade, and I don't get permission from her, but it's still from Christy, but maybe just intellectually she's just still in the...
Yeah, and her memory capacity is not going to be as refined as what Christy's is.
I found memories of Christmas and such, but I've been away from it for a couple of years, and when I went back and saw my nieces and nephews involved with this, I've never felt so empty in my whole life, and Tom and I are struggling with it. Our kids could probably go another Christmas or two and not even realize that they were supposed to get presents.
Mm-hmm.
They can't read a calendar, they don't understand that. But if you want to go to the extreme, there is a St. Nicholas Day. It's like December 13th or something, mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact date. Make that the day that Santa comes and just keep Christmas. Don't give presents on Christmas Day. Now that's to the extreme, and this isn't what we decided upon. This is just something we're considering, and something mm-hmm. we're going to have to face in about a year or two when Joshua realizes that all the kids at Sunday school are getting presents today, and they can't wait to get home to wait till, you know, Tom's done preaching so they can go home and get those presents, you know. So I really struggle with that too.
I think another possibility is why do the presents that arrive on Christmas have to be presents from Santa Claus?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why can't they be presents from mom and dad and presents from brothers and sisters and presents from aunts and uncles? And why does there have to be some mystery package from some fantasy person? Mark?
Just a general comment, and you throw it in wherever you want to fit. I think a mistake, at least from my perspective, and then we'll find out as we get more directly active in our own parenting role, but listening to friends who've had kids, they often make the mistake of assuming that it's too early to start dealing with kids, be it helping around the house, be it doing whatever, sort of like, well, there's this magical age called very early childhood in which you've got this very innocent little thing who is totally incapable of doing anything and determining reality and whatever. I think a lot of it is you start dealing with the child as a young Christian, regardless which of these categories we're in, from day one. You may occasionally go over the top of their head, but if you don't make this phony distinction, but from day one stress, Jesus is a real person, Jesus came as a baby just like you were, and do that from day one, that's their understanding, the faith that Spirit puts in our heart, and the form that we help give to that as they're able to develop language skills and things. I think if we start from day one on, we'll have a lot less problems. Because I know we have friends in Des Moines who, this falls more in the emotional discipline range, they would let their kids get away with everything because, they're too young, they won't understand until age 4 or 5, they're having problems, and we told them about friends of ours, an assistant pastor in the Cleveland area, who at 2 and 3 had beautifully behaved children. And our friends did not say, well, how is that even possible? Well, it's because you laid out the rules and understandings and whatever from day one. And that's the way the kids develop.
One important thing to mention developmentally is that children understand more up here before they can begin to express it here. And so what you say to them may have meaning that they can't even begin to express to you in terms of how much of it they're understanding, but they're taking it all in. And preschool ends up being kind of a fun age level to deal with because children have growing communication skills. The 2-year-old is still working on getting those phrases out and may not get them out real clearly and is beginning to put sentences together, and words are a wonderful thing for the 2-year-old. But the preschooler then becomes able to use words to really communicate and converse and whatever. And sometimes that can get frustrating because it's always, well, tell me about this, or why did this happen, or whatever. And it's a constant barrage of why, and being real curious about everything. But really, it's a wonderful age. And that's, I think, unfortunately, as Mark was saying, when parents say, well, now they can talk back to me, now I can start to help them understand some of these kinds of things. Well, they're understanding things well before they can express things back to you verbally. And so it's really important to start from the very earliest, giving them some of those.
But what about imaginary friends? I mean, when is it healthy? When is it not healthy? When do they start to develop those imaginary friends?
That is probably something that's going to develop right during the age range that we're talking about. And this is probably as good a place as any to talk about it in terms of emotional development and social development. Children will develop imaginary friends, and they do so for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's because of their need for some social support. And sometimes it's just a process of the imagination of their mental and intellectual abilities at that point in time. In terms of handling imaginary friends, I think it's fine to play along with it for a child. If they have an imaginary friend who they have at the table with you every night for supper and you need to set a plate out and forks and spoons and pretend that somebody's sitting there, that's perfectly appropriate to do. to play along with it, because it's something that children outgrow when their sense of peers, the real world of peers, becomes increasingly important to them. But it often happens in families where there is not as much social contact, or not siblings in the family for whom they can play with and relate to. It becomes an idea, hey, I'd like to have somebody who's with me all the time, sort of a thing. And so they invent this person who's very real to them.
So you're saying that if you notice this and it's very developed, it could be a process that they're being isolated or maybe not paying enough attention?
You may want to encourage a little more social behavior, but it may just be a stage for that particular child and not something that you have to panic about and think, oh no, they've got an imaginary friend. It means they don't have enough friends outside of the home and I've got to do something about it. It's not that kind of a thing. It's recognizing that this is a stage that they're going through. I'll encourage and foster that imaginary friend relationship, but I'll also provide opportunities for other social relationships. And that often happens once they start school anyway. They're going to be surrounded by other social relationships and almost can't avoid having that step in.
Our 9-year-old daughter had 3 imaginary friends in the time she was 2 to 5, and it did diminish when she started school, but now I'm not seeing that developing in our 2 younger children, and I was concerned that they're not developing their imagination as much.
It's not something that every child goes through. Certain children, for whatever reason, be it emotional makeup or genetic characteristics or who knows what, some children have that need and develop that kind of a thing, and other children do not. It's definitely not something where every child's going to experience this, and if your child doesn't, there's something wrong. Okay, go ahead.
I'm trying to teach about Jesus. I had a lot of preschoolers that for a while, Jesus was their imaginary friend. You know, Jesus is doing this with us, and Jesus is doing that with us. And it was good in the fact that they were remembering that, you know, and it kind of curbed their behavior to the good because Jesus was there doing that with them. So I didn't know if it okay for them to have Jesus as their imaginary friend.
And I don't know that you necessarily need to say imaginary friend, because he's not imaginary. He is a real being. We just can't see him. And I experienced the same thing as I was teaching preschoolers. As a matter of fact, when we would sit down for snack, they would make sure that there was a place at the table for Jesus. And when we would have our story time, they would pull out a carpet, and that was Jesus' carpet square, so that Jesus could listen to the story too. And I thought that was really a wonderful and beautiful expression of what is the faith of a young child, to recognize that it was somebody they couldn't see, but his presence was very real, enough so that he needed a place to sit too. And so I would not phrase him as imaginary friend, but invisible friend, yes. Yeah, very much so. Okay. All right. In terms of intellectual development, the preschooler has a growing reasoning ability, which we talked about a little bit. They're going to be asking why a lot, and you will hear a lot of whys in terms of discipline techniques that you use. Well, why can't I do such and such when you say whatever. That's not disrespect. And it's real easy, I think, for parents to think that children are being sassy or children are being disrespectful or children are talking back, when all they are doing is expressing to you the fact that their mind and their reasoning powers are getting stronger all the time, and they really want to understand. They really have a need to understand things intellectually. They're beginning to master language, so they're very conversational. They enjoy having choices, and we're going to talk a lot about choices when we talk about discipline and guidance techniques with young children, because it's real crucial to give them opportunities to practice that and to practice not only making those choices, but also following through with whatever the consequences are of the choices that they do decide to make. Mary.
Going back to your why, like even in discipline, I did that, like with my oldest two, and you know, I was explaining to them, well, this is why you're going to sit on a chair, and this is why you're going to do this, and this is why this is happening, and whatever. And now that they're getting older, I'm going, I'm tired of telling you why all the time, or even if I told you once, and then they come back at me again with, you know, just trying to get away from it. How long do you keep it? I'm going, Christy to me is like an older 5-year-old, she's in preschool, but she's 5 and a half, not just turning 5. You know, and Anne's already in first grade, and I don't get much from her, but I still from Christy, but maybe just intellectually she's just still at the...
Yeah, and her memory capacity is not going to be as refined as what Christie's is. And so, Anne is the older one?
Yeah.
Okay. And so it seems like you just told them something. Sometimes they really didn't remember it. And that gets to be a frustrating thing for preschool teachers as well as parents. It seems like you're repeating the same things over and over and over again. But it's not so much the children are ignoring what it is you've said before. They're just so here and now oriented that they don't even think of what you might have told them before in a similar situation. It's going to be a developing ability for them, though. Be reassured. Mark?
Should you, like in Mary's case, make verbal reference back for them, be connecting back, instead of just saying, I'm frustrated because X, Y, Z, do you remember when I told you that?
Yeah.
Sometimes I do it, but a lot of times she's getting to the point where I can tell her this is why you need to do this, and she comes right back at me with the next question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not another different instance. It's just right then.
Mm-hmm.
I just told you in the last sentence why you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried reversing roles on her?
Asking her
why.
Well, and that's a possible approach in terms of saying back to her, well, you tell me why. You tell me why I'm having you sit here. And get her to express. And maybe it is that what you're saying, she hears what you're saying, but she doesn't understand what it really means. And so by getting her to translate for you, what does that mean? What am I telling you? Why is it that you need to be sitting here? She may say something that really doesn't convey what you were trying to convey with whatever your words were. So I would try turning the tables that way. The real difficult thing, and we'll talk about this when we get into guiding behavior, is for yourself as a parent to, as much as possible, keep your growing irritation under control and try to talk through these kinds of things very calmly. That's probably the biggest struggle that all of us have, is that when it's you've done it already so many times with this child and it's come up again and again, or you're frustrated at that moment and what you don't need is to have a child say, but why do I have to do this? It requires so much self-control to be able to still talk with them rationally and calmly and try to help it be an understanding, mutual understanding kind of a thing rather than a blow-up. Now, on the other hand, if you know that a child is just saying why to badger you and you really feel that that's where they're coming from, I think it's appropriate to say, I've answered your question for you. I'm not going to talk to you anymore about it. If you have questions about it later on, that's fine. But for now, you need to sit here and just let it go at that.
I think most of my problems coming in at that way, I tell her to come in and her best friend and all other kids are still playing. Why do I have to come in? Because it's time for you to come in. I'm your mom. This is the time that I say, why do I have to come in? Because I told you.
Right. And one of the things that's real important, I think, again, in that kind of circumstance is the empathy and conveying that empathy to a child. It doesn't change your decision about whether or not they need to come inside, but I know you'd rather stay out here and play with your friends right now, but it's time for you to come inside. So what you're saying is, I acknowledge the way you feel, I respect the way you feel, but that doesn't change my decision, you still need to come inside. And I think that really needs to be conveyed. And it sounds simplistic and whatever, but I really think, even us as adults, when somebody says, boy, I really do know how you feel, it's not going to change your situation, but I really do understand how you feel, for some reason that settles us a little bit. We're able to cope with it a little bit better because somebody else says, boy, I can see why you'd feel that way. So I think it's real important to convey that to a young child.
A thought just occurred to me, I throw it out, I don't know whether it works, fits or doesn't. Is it appropriate to, if you will, I'll put it in legal terms, contract with a child before the child, or as the child is out to play, to say, more or less to establish a parameter, now remember, we go to bed at 8 o'clock, and I'll be calling to come back in. I mean, the child may not remember, but then when the child gives you, why can't I remember what we said when you went out to play? You had to come back in at 8 o'clock.
I think it's a real good strategy. Besides being something where you're helping a child get time perception, which is something that's a growing skill also. It's not something that they have right away. But besides giving them an opportunity to gain that time perception, what you're doing, then you do have something to lean back on. Remember, we talked about it before you went outside, and we said that you would come in at 7:30, and here's my watch, and it says 7:30, so it's time to come in.
And it's not just the time perception either. We do things like that with our three-year-old, like he could sit and eat and drink juice all day long, and I'll tell him what I give him the last cup, this is your last cup of juice until supper time. And then he doesn't throw a fit. But if I don't say that, and he asks for more, and I say, no, then he throws a fit.
Yeah, and what it does for them is it helps them understand that your behavior isn't just on a whim. You're not coming outside because you want to ruin their day and you don't care if they're having fun with their friends or whatever, but you're going to be mean mom and you're going to come out and say, get in. They need to know that it's a pre-planned kind of a thing, that it's something that you're doing for their benefit, and that's something you have planned ahead of time, you've talked with them about ahead of time, so that when it comes, it's not as much of a surprise. Kind of ties in when teachers are trying to get children, or even parents, when parents are trying to get children to clean up in a couple of minutes because we're going to be leaving to go to grandma's or go to the grocery store or go to Sunday school or whatever it might be. If you let them know about 10 minutes or 5 minutes before it's time to go that in 5 minutes we're going to need to leave to go to church, then when you say 5 minutes later, okay, you need to put the toys down because it's time to go to church, they already knew 5 minutes ago that they should be winding down. If you don't give them that advance warning at all, it's like, what do you mean it's time to go? I'm not done playing yet. It's going to make them blow up unnecessarily because you haven't forewarned them about what your plans are.
One thing we've done that really helps, and we may have to start using it with the younger children, is we use the buzzer a lot. When the buzzer goes off in 5 minutes, it'll be time to stop playing and put your toys away. Or when the buzzer goes off, if you're not finishing,
that can be a real effective approach. Fisher Price just recently came out with what I think it looks like the niftiest thing. I probably should buy one now. They'll be obsolete before our child gets that old. But it's a watch that's got, it's not an actual watch, it's a stopwatch kind of a thing that children can wear on a wristband, and they can set it for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, and at the end of that time, it beeps. And so they can actually punch in how much time. And, you know, for a four-year-old or a five-year-old, it'd be wonderful for them to independently punch in 5 minutes, and then when it beep, 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 beeps, then it's time to do whatever it is coming up in 5 minutes. So it's really a nice kind of a thing. Your other comment?
The other thing I wanted to mention was something about when we're having a discussion about what Mary was saying, and they keep coming back with why, or I don't want to, or why is this. I will state my statement. We're going to do this, and this is why we're going to do it. And I have them, sometimes I have to hold their face, have them really look at me, and then I'll say, now, what did I say? And have them repeat exactly what I said. So I am sure that they did hear me. They may not understand it, but they heard exactly what I said. And I heard them repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that sort of agreement. And that takes a lot of practice.
Especially to do it calmly. You don't want to grab your child's face and say, okay, go ahead.
Consistency also important. Because children can be manipulated and use this why as knowing, I can badger mom for 5 minutes and she'll have to give in then.
And if I badger long enough, she'll give in. Right, right. Yes, consistency is very, very important. Very, very important. Can't overemphasize the need for that. Follow through, I think, is what you're talking about also, which is if you say you're going to do something, no amount of whining on the part of your child is going to change your mind, and it's going to have to be that way.
And if you do it, I heard a 3:30, you do it once, I've told you now, if you don't do this, and third, I told you, now you have to take time out or whatever it is that you think.
Some people may be comfortable with 3, some people may be comfortable with fewer than 3. I told you to do something, and you didn't follow through. What happens often is that we let it go much longer than 3 times of reminding. And then we sound like nags. I mean, really, we do. We're keeping on saying the same stuff, and children are going to tune it out just because they've heard it before, and they know that you can keep talking, and it won't really do anything. I think sometimes mothers get themselves into that, and their last statement is, we'll just wait till your dad comes home. That's something my mom always used to do, and she and I had a real difficult time in high school, when I was in high school, just because of that, because I didn't see her as a powerful person then. She didn't have any control, really. all she had to do was threaten that when Dad came home, he'd take care of things, and he did. But when my dad said something, it went, and I mean, he followed through like immediately, and that makes all the difference in the world. It's not that fathers have some magical power over their children. It's that usually, mothers will let it go and let it go and let it go and let it go, and finally say, I give up, wait till your dad comes home, and Dad will say, we're going to talk about alternatives to that.
Yeah, I think that's what the mother will try and try not to get angry, but to get more angry with his
right. Okay. A couple other things in terms of intellectual development. They've got a brief attention span. They're easily distracted, but they are improving in their abilities to concentrate. Because of the fact that they learn by doing, we talked about concrete experiences for children, and I want to make a distinction for you in terms of concrete versus some other levels of ability. Concrete experiences would be something like, if you want your child to learn about a cat and you want your child to learn concretely about a cat, you're going to bring a live cat, and you're going to let them see it and touch it and taste it and smell it and whatever it is they're going to do. They're going to experience it with all their senses, okay? That's a concrete experience for a child. At the next level up, which takes a little more intellectual understanding, is what's called the iconic level. It's I-C-O-N-I-C. At that level, pictures convey the information. So you could bring into your child a picture book about cats, and they could see the pictures of the cats to see what a cat looks like. But by feeling that page, they're not going to get an idea about what that cat feels like, what the fur feels like. They're not going to be able to hear that cat sound, the purring sound or the meows or whatever, from what's the picture on the page. So it's limiting how many senses they can use to experience something like that. And then at the very top of that is something at a symbolic level, which is something where you just have a representation of that. For us, CAT, written on a board, will convey images in our head of that animal that we've had a chance to experience both concretely and iconically. What happens often with very young children is that, and part of it is the academic push that we're getting into, trying to get them ready for school and whatever, is that we change their learning experiences too quickly from concrete learning experiences to iconic experiences or even symbolic experiences. We, instead of giving them a chance to learn about number by playing with things, pennies or whatever kind of a thing to count and put in places and whatever and group together in different ways, instead of giving them that, we give them a worksheet that shows pictures of pennies and say, how many is here? And you can count them, but you can't feel them and you can't move them around and can't help sort them in a way that's going to make sense to you concretely. Or you give them abstract addition problems, 3 + 4 = and all too often that kind of stuff starts to leak into the preschool program for children before they're ready to handle things at that kind of a level. And typically what will happen is that the child who already has had a lot of concrete experiences will take one of those worksheet kinds of things and be able to do it. But all it is for them is a rehearsal of skills they've already learned. For the child who hasn't had those concrete experiences before them, when they get that worksheet, it's not going to be an experience in success. They don't have the concrete experience to build it on. It's an exercise in failure for them. It doesn't have meaning. They can't experience it concretely. They do it and they get it wrong, but doing it over and over and over again isn't going to help build that rightness for them. So it ends up being something that's real. Maybe helpful, maybe not. There are probably better uses of children's time who have those skills than to spend their time rehearsing those skills with a worksheet. But it certainly does not teach the skills to children who haven't had the concrete experiences with those skills. So it's really important to give them as much information, hands-on, as you possibly can. It's important to remember that play is a child's work. And the kinds of play experiences that you want your child to have include things like dramatic play experiences, trying out different roles. So it's not a bad idea to have at home a dress-up box that's got all kinds of odds and ends from garage sales or whatever that children can make believe with. It's real important for them to practice some of those roles. Arts and music experiences, art and music experiences, those are the kinds of things that help your child express themselves, express their individuality. And I'm not talking here about craft kinds of things where they're putting something together to look like something. I'm talking about just messing with the media sort of a thing. Seeing what crayons do, if you bang them on a sheet like this versus use them flat versus color with them the way you color with them. That kind of a thing is real important for children, to give them a chance to experience the media in as flexible a way as possible. Sensory experiences where they're discovering attributes of the physical world. It's no accident that children often love tub time, especially if tub time is a time when you give them lots of extra time. It's not just wash-up time, but they can take some cups and some squeeze bottles and whatever in there with them and really do some playing around. They're learning properties about the physical world when they do that. It's not just playtime, it's learning time, and it's real important learning time for them. Same as with digging with a shovel in the mud out in your backyard. They may not choose the best place to dig. It may be where you just planted your spring bulbs, but it's really important. They're learning attributes of the physical world by experimenting in that way. Constructive play, things like play with blocks, with Legos, with things that go together that help them understand spatial relations, are the kinds of things that develop math skills, beginning math skills. So those kinds of materials are important for a child to have. Books are really, really important. There's probably nothing that you can do that's more beneficial to a child than to spend some time reading to them. It helps them connect some of the real and symbolic sorts of things. Definitely is an important pre-reading kind of a thing. Oftentimes children who are good readers are children whose parents have spent a lot of time reading to them, exposing them to print in a variety of ways. And so it's going to expand their vocabulary when you're reading stories to them. You want to provide for them not only picture books that are intended for children to look at independently, but also story books where it's a little longer and it increases their attention span because they're listening to a longer storyline. But also make use of resource books. We don't know everything, and it's important for children to see us as adults model that we don't know everything. And if we don't know, there are places to find out. And so we model for them the use of reference books like encyclopedias, or going to the library to get a book on lizards if that's what your child might be interested in. You may not know very much about lizards. So you show a child that when you don't know about something, there are ways to find out. And what you're doing is modeling for them some really good research kinds of skills. When you don't know, there are ways to find out. So those are some of the intellectual kinds of emphases. Yes?
Not to take away from the spiritual side, but I know you've mentioned before having parents use household tasks as learning experiences too, that you don't segregate the kid away from helping around the house, but you turn that helping into a learning experience.
Right. When a child does things like set the table for supper, the fact that they have put one fork where every plate is a math skill. It's a one-to-one correspondence kind of a skill, which is an important developmental beginning math skill where they're matching one thing with one other thing. And so by just putting the forks around the table at each plate, you're giving your child a pre-math experience. That's just one example of the kinds of things your child can be learning by participating with household chores. Things like helping you sort the laundry into white things versus non-white things helps them also with a mathematical kind of thing, which is classifying things into different categories. All kinds of household things that children can be doing that are going to really be learning experiences for them and real valuable. And the thing to do is to involve them in those when they're willing to do that kind of a thing, which is the preschool years. They want to help with everything. Even though you could do it a lot more efficiently by yourself, they really do want to participate. And if you wait and say, well, when they're bigger and more coordinated, I'll involve them, that's going to be a time when they're not really going to want to be involved too much with you. And so you establish those habits and those routines real early so that you can continue those patterns rather than trying to start them at a time where a child doesn't really have much interest in participating with you. Okay, a little bit about spiritual development, just because we're going to cover that again in another area. God is a person that children are going to view in human terms because of their concreteness. They're going to have difficulties with the abstract nature of God, but don't we all? Jesus is going to be a very special person to young children because Jesus is the person who was a baby like they were. And Jesus is a person who has experienced everything that human beings can experience. He was hungry, and he cried, and he did all those things that children can experience. And it's comforting to a child to know that they have a God who experiences things exactly the way they experience them. And so Jesus becomes a very special person to young children, and that's who they're going to really develop their important relationship with. God as creator is an also important image for young children, because they're so into the world and discovering things about the world, and to think that somebody made it all makes that person be such a wondrous and awesome person to the young child. So those two emphases are real important. One of the things I'd like to talk to you about is your role as parents in that. There's probably a tremendous responsibility placed on us as parents because of a child's inability to think of things abstractly so much as concretely. What they will assume if they know that God is a person over people is that you are somewhat a model of God, because you are the biggest person they can think of that's over them. And so it places some real responsibilities toward us in terms of really trying to convey to our children God's attributes. So we want to be unconditionally loving to our children, because that's what God is for us. We want to be forgiving of our children, because that's what God is for us. That doesn't mean that we let them go away thinking that we're perfect and that we're God-like. They need to recognize that we are sinners also. And so when you blow up at a child and get irrational with them and just get so growingly irritated that you say things that later you wish you wouldn't have said, there's nothing wrong with a parent saying to a child, "I shouldn't have done that. I am really sorry. Would you forgive me?" Because that forgiveness and that relationship kind of a thing helps children not only understand you from your parental role, but also from your role as a fellow sinner. And it's important for that kind of relationship to be established between you and your child also. That parents sometimes make mistakes too. Children, I think, are more readily to admit when they've done wrong if they don't have a parental image that says, "I always do what's right." Okay, they're able to say, "I shouldn't have done that. That was bad." If they also hear parents say when things that they've done wrong, "I shouldn't have done that." Did you have a comment or question?
Yes, pastors are very much seen as God. I don't know how many of those kids in Vicarage, Hillsburg, and on say, "There's God."
That's right.
So it's important for us as pastors to treat them as people, to know who they are, to use their name, to get down to their level so they can relate to us as pastors.
Right. On Sunday morning, when you show up in church wearing a white robe and all the pictures they've ever seen of Jesus, particularly you guys that are bearded, are bearded men in white robes, it starts to connect for young children in terms of that concreteness. This must be Jesus himself. We're going to God's house, and here's this man who's got a beard and a white robe, and oh my, it must be Jesus himself. I think your own children, because of your role as pastors, will probably have a more realistic perception of a pastor than what maybe children outside of church families will, just because they will see you in other contexts besides Sunday morning. But I do think it says something about your responsibility as pastors to the young children in your congregation and the kind of image they have of you. I also think it's important for them to see you as pastor, not always in your white robe, not always looking like a Jesus figure, but somebody who is a real person underneath, too. So you want to have opportunities to greet children, maybe when they're in their Sunday school classes or whatever, become a real familiar face to them in other than your Sunday garb. Okay. Young children are capable of very strong expressions of faith. And when Scripture talks about the faith of a young child, for those of you who have had the opportunity to experience anything from a young child, a faith statement from a young child, it is phenomenal the way the Lord can speak through children. I have heard people say, people who are in my same field of education, who have said that for the young child, faith really is more just kind of trust, and they trust in him the way they kind of trust in adults and whatever. My personal feeling, as well as my personal experience with young children, is that baptism instills faith in that young child at a level that supersedes some of their other abilities. Our spiritual nature is something that's not necessarily limited by our human limitations, and so children can convey important truths to us spiritually. And I just want to give you an example of, and it was one of those out of the mouth of babes kind of a stories that really impacted me as a preschool teacher. I had two children who were arguing as to which one of them had me as their teacher. She's my teacher, no, she's my teacher, no, she's my teacher, and they went back and forth with this. And so I went over and talked with them and had said, actually, I'm the teacher of both of you. Well, this was a day where I was really down and had thought that I didn't carry much of that into the classroom with me. Evidently, children can also read adult emotions fairly well. But anyway, they were in this argument, and I had said, well, I'm the teacher of both of you. And one of the boys looked up at me, and he said, and Jesus is your teacher, isn't he? And I said, yes. And he said, and he takes care of everything for you, doesn't he? And it was like, whoa, did I need to hear that today? Children's faith is phenomenal, and children can do that kind of a thing. If you're willing to share with them your faith and let them know that you also believe in that wonderful person that they believe in, and that God, even though he's invisible, is a reality in your life. We also talked about children's concreteness and the fact that they believe what they can see, but also they're going to believe because of what the Spirit in them allows them to believe. They're going to believe in a very physical presence of Jesus, like we had talked about in terms of saving a place at the table for him and saving a carpet for story time for him. They're going to see him as a very real being. And that, I think, is one of the most faith-strengthening things to us as adults, to be able to see him as a very real being. We kind of outgrow our ability, I think, sometimes to be able to see Christ in that way. And so it really gets to be faith-refreshing to have young children reinstill for us that confidence that even though we can't see him, he is very real in our lives. The focus of the rest of the workshop will be on specific ways that we as parents can nurture the development of our preschoolers in what I consider to be three of the most crucial of these foundational areas. The first being the child's relationship to himself. And what we want to focus on there is encouraging the growth of positive self-esteem. I think that's one of the most crucial gifts that you can give to your child is a healthy sense of their self and their abilities. Secondly, we want to focus on a child's relationship to you and others, so we're going to talk a little bit about guiding their behavior, helping them develop self-control and appropriate social behavior. And then finally, we'll close with talking about ways that we can enhance a child's relationship to his or her Lord, because I think also that's a role where you play a real crucial kind of a position in terms of your young child's faith development, so we're going to focus on those three areas. We'll be doing a little bit of hypothetical situations where we'll brainstorm about ways to solve some particular problems. When we get to talking about some discipline issues, there's a videotape that I have that I'd like to share with you on discipline issues and handling behavior. And then we'll just kind of continue with our discussional format here. I appreciate all the input that you are offering too. It is really helpful to have you offer your insights as well as having me present mine. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and take a break now, because you've been sitting for a long time. If you want to grab a cup of coffee and another donut, maybe need a bathroom break or whatever, go ahead, and we'll gather up again in about 5 minutes. Justine? Okay. Thank you. I didn't even see your hand. I assumed you all did. Okay, we want to talk about some of the characteristics of children who have both high senses of self-esteem and low senses of self-esteem. How would you describe a child who you felt had a positive sense of self-esteem or a high sense of self-esteem? What kind of characteristics would that child have? Confidence. Confidence? Okay.
Momentary defeat will devastate them.
Okay, able to bounce back from failures. Other characteristics? Often a child with a low sense of self-esteem will often say, I can't, before they even try. Okay, you'll hear that often. Pessimistic outlook on life. Usually their social attempts are fairly unsuccessful. Okay. What I want to focus on a little bit is what happens in terms of cycles of esteem. For the child who's got a low sense of self-esteem, they're approaching the world, they're approaching every social situation from a I don't really like me kind of an outlook. And so that dislike conveys itself by the assumption that I don't like me, so other people don't like me either. When you feel that other people don't like you, you're going to do one of two things, which is what you talked about. Withdraw. They don't like me anyway. I'm not going to participate. I'm not even going to try because I know they're not going to like what they find out. Or more aggressive kinds of outbursts. I'm going to prove to you guys that I'm part of the gang. I'm going to prove to you that I can be better than what I think I am. So you have that kind of a thing, withdrawal or aggression. What happens is that the child who reacts either by withdrawing socially or by acting aggressive usually gets confirmation of this assumption. The child who causes outbursts and who acts obnoxious often is responded to by other children by saying, boy, what an obnoxious kid. We don't want to play with him or her. And so that confirms, yep, I was right. They don't like me. So after all, I must not be a likable person. And it ends up doing this vicious cycle for the child. Same thing happens, though, in terms of a child who basically approaches life with an, I like who I am. I'm a valuable person. I'm a pretty neat kid. When a person approaches life that way, since they feel good about who they are, they assume other people feel that way, too. And so when you feel that other people feel pretty good about who you are, you're likely to reach out socially. And when you reach out socially, other people say, wow, he wants to be my friend. I want to be his friend too. And that ends up confirming your assumption that, yeah, I'm pretty likable. Yeah, other people really do like me. And that reinforces your like for yourself. And so it ends up being a cycle of positive esteem. Now, that's not to say that sometimes, even though you think other people are going to accept you, that they don't. But on the whole, the kinds of experiences you get are going to be real positive. And often that happens with very young children. Unless somebody is not aware that they're in a negative cycle and doesn't help stop that negative cycle. And then it recurs and recurs and recurs through the elementary school years and ends up being a real tough thing to deal with. I have probably met more adults that say to me, I really wish I had more confidence in myself. I know self-esteem is something that I struggle with. It's something that my husband struggles with. It's something that a lot of people that we know struggle with. And I'm not sure exactly what the roots are of that. For me personally, I suppose, delve into my family and try to find out what did that. Although I can say that I know that my mother was not a very self-confident person. She had a very low sense of self-esteem and struggles with that still. And so there was probably some modeling of that kind of a thing in my family. And I know that's also true for Mark and his family. His mother also suffered with a lack of self-esteem. And so when you realize that that's your bent, that you're already operating from maybe some not so positive feelings about yourself, you probably need to work even harder at making sure that your child doesn't grow up with those same feelings, just so that they can establish a more positive cycle for themselves and be able to handle things maybe a little more confidently than you feel that you're able to do. I think it's important to mention that positive self-esteem can be thought of maybe as a positive thing. However, I've heard some people express some concern about children getting overly confident in themselves. I did some looking into scripture in terms of whether or not positive self-esteem was an appropriate Christian attribute. I believe that it is in terms of what Scripture has to say. Otherwise, how can Christ command husbands to love their wives as they love their own bodies? Or how can the second commandment, the summary of that group of commandments, be love your neighbor as yourself? I think there's a real strong emphasis on that. However, there also is warnings in Scripture in terms of humility and not being proud. But in Matthew 18, Christ talks about a child being greatest in the kingdom of God. Whoever humbles himself like a child is the greatest in the kingdom of God. And I think that says something about positive sense of self-esteem in children and where they're likely to take that at early ages. Before children become real social beings, they need to feel good about themselves and who they are. The pride comes in when you start noticing other people's abilities and start comparing yourself with others and starting to elevate yourself above somebody else. For the real young child who hasn't begun to notice very much about other people but is still working out who it is they are on the inside, it's real crucial for them to have those feelings that I'm a pretty neat kid. There's a lot of things that I can do.